This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. There is no one way to write a poem. Some writers start with an image or a story, but poet Janice Fuller draws three words from a large bank and uses them to jumpstart her creativity. Her latest collection is comprised of poems she wrote while working on a theatrical production of William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. Each time she sat down to write, no matter what three random words she chose, she continued to return to the play's central themes of aging, death, and burial. It is called, her latest collection of poetry is called On the Bevel, and Janice Fuller joins us now to talk about it. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
So
it's nice to be here.
Tell us about how this became the muse for your latest collection.
Well, for 5 years I had tried to adapt As I Lay Dying into a play, stage play, and my friend at Catawba, Beth Homan, was going to direct it, and it was one of the most exciting processes I've ever been through. We went up to Tectonic Theater with the cast and worked on moment work, and so I was really engaged with it. But I like to work on more than one project at a time, and so often I would say, okay, I'm going to pull my words and just see what comes. And the shadow of that large coffin in As I Lay Dying was there, and the themes and the sensibility of it. So I just kept finding myself writing. I didn't set out to write a parallel book, but I did find some connections.
But you said you'd been working on the adaptation for a while, so clearly this work meant a lot to you.
It did. It did. I am from working class Southern background, and what I love about As I Lay Dying is, first of all, its experimental form and its use of stream of consciousness, but also that it gives dignity to the poorest of the poor. In the middle of this dysfunction of this family, there are moments of heroism, and that speaks to me.
Well, and it's a real stripped down, I'm going to call it a stripped down heroism, stripped of a lot of the cultural affectations or expectations of glory and heroism that we would apply to that word.
Yes.
It is a root essential kind of dignity, isn't it?
It is. And one of the characters that I keep coming back to, Cash Bundren, who's a carpenter, his way of being, of honoring his mother, and the way he achieves heroism in my mind is that as she's dying, he holds up boards that he's sawing to make her coffin, and it becomes his way of having dignity in the face of just a nightmarish situation.
You have to try to make some sense of it. And On the Bevel, I think, is a clue to that kind of work, that handiwork, certainly carpentry. Tell us about the title.
Yes. Well, the title in the novel, when Addie Bundren, the mother, finally dies, everybody's in a rush. It's flooding with the rain, torrential rain, and they're trying to take her body across the river to Jefferson to be buried with her family. And he is meticulously insisting on finishing the coffin in the way he planned. And they kept saying, you don't need to make it on the bevel. And he has a 13 reasons in a comic, tragic list of why he thinks it has to be made on the bevel. Very practical things like, oh, well, the rain will only seep in if there's a bevel. But then he keeps coming back to, well, it makes a neater job. And I think there's something aesthetic about it as well, that he wants the beauty for his mother.
Well, and these sharp angles are not it, that if we're going to find the truth, it's going to be curved. It's not going to be, at right angles to itself.
No, and I think Faulkner is so aware, even by having all these different characters approach truth and the reality in dramatically different ways, that there's a bevel of truth. We can't have a strict single answer.
Janice, can I get you to read a poem for us?
Yes, I'd be delighted. I'm going to start with Street Lamp on Claiborne Street. It does mention the Lloyd George Museum. This book was published by a Welsh publisher, Cinnamon Press, and I go over and teach almost every summer at Tynawyth, which is the National Writing School, and it was the last home of David Lloyd George, the only Welsh prime minister. And so that one reference is there. Street Lamp on Claiborne Street. I know nothing about astronomy, just the Big Dipper, the North Star, a bar of flex, a neck craning. Once, in the Lloyd George Museum, I lay on my back in the stargazing tent, the mobile planetarium, children clustered around me. The Dipper was a saucepan, the guide said, and those scattered ones, twin stars conjoined but pulling apart, the start of a new galaxy? patterns with no name or meaning, only light's wrinkle. When I was small, an only child, the nightlight was never on when I needed it. Each evening, I'd stand with the black stairs at my back, staring at the street lamp outside my window. A cup of light, a golden wand, splitting in from out, safe from not. Is this real? I'd ask the steady eye. Did someone dream me? Is this my hand? Where is the window? The telephone wires, the dark dogwood branch. Today, I am a constellation. Navel, ripples, wrinkled fingers, eyelashes, fewer each day. Sleep rearranges me. Daylight reassembles. I write this to you now, old streetlight by my window, still hoping you'll glow me an answer.
Janice Moore Fuller reading Street Lamp on Claiborne Street from her latest collection, On the Bevel. Janice teaches English at Catawba College and is here with us today. So you asked the steady eye. What's the steady eye?
The steady eye would, I guess, be, in one way of understanding, the street lamp itself. But, you know, the epigraph that I have for the book, one of the two, is from Simone Weil, and it's Two Forces Rule the Universe, Light and Gravity, which I think is such an interesting way of seeing the world. And gravity is all through As I Lay Dying, the body weighing us down, a girl being having an unwanted pregnancy, someone dying, the body sagging. But in my poems, I keep finding myself being drawn towards transcendence or light, some answer for something more than the corporeal selves that we seem to be stuck with.
And of course, light has proven the rest of our physics by famously bending around mass.
Yes.
Once that happened, it turned out Einstein, we could breathe a sigh of relief. He was right.
Yes.
So and that's that light and that curvature, the indefinability of light is an important theme in your work as well.
I think so. I don't know if I had known that until you just said it, but I think it is as there's a potential to bend just like the bevel hopefully bends a straight piece of wood.
I wonder if I can get you to read another poem for us.
Sure. I'm going to read Relics of the Martyr. This is a poem about Matthew Shepard, who was murdered because of his sexual orientation in Wyoming, but it's directed towards his partner. Matthew was a student at Catawba for one semester. His partner graduated from Catawba and was and still is one of my best friends. So this is a poem that deals with the immeasurable grief that he experienced. It's in three parts. Relics of the Martyr. 1. Barbed wire in Wyoming. You sleep with your arms around Mickey, the mouse, your back to the wall so nothing can creep from behind. Only the boy you loved can come to you, young but bludgeoned. His laugh still clear, a shock of blonde shielding his eye. 2. First-person expansion. Watch out for pronouns. Strangers colonize with we. On the TV, we have occupied your grief, leaving you nothing but scraps in a book, a cup of rocky soil, a cigar box full of bones. 3. Spring. The fingers of the dead stop growing. Only hair and nails still reach. When you cut the grass low, look for them, sprouting like crocuses from the earth.
Janice Moore Fuller reading Relics of the Martyr from her collection On the Bevel. You really put us in mind in that poem of the double grief of someone who has had to share their grief with the public.
Absolutely. And as wonderful in some ways as the movement that took Matt's death and tried to make social change from it, it was still a difficulty for someone who had a very private grief to every time he would think about moving on, it would be the anniversary and there'd be images everywhere.
Yeah, and it also, I think, getting back to this notion of light, the way it proves the roundness of our experience and the fact that it's a continuum also shames us into the way we've constructed gender, the way we've constructed our ideas about normality and norms that have utterly crushed human beings.
Yeah.
And we can't talk about them. I mean, getting back to censorship, you know, As I Lay Dying was in fact censored in Kentucky in 1986.
It was. And go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying it's sort of fascinating to think of this great work of literature. It had some words in it that bothered people, but this is a book that does not flinch in the face of death, and you wonder to what extent that just proved too much for those parents.
I think that may be more the issue than any of the language that might seem irreverent. There is no pulling back from the buzzards circling the decaying body. And that I'm teaching an honors course next semester on death and dying with Dr. Aaron Wood in the psychology department. And we'll do something. It's a long work to try to deal with all we're going to do. But I do think it's an important work to just look unflinchingly at the body after death.
Well, and I think it points to something in your work with light, the way we try to grapple with this crazy concept of light, a thing that, you know, whose speed we cannot achieve, which this thing that illuminates the world and is invisible. I mean, you know, so we've got these ultimate paradoxes that we have to come to terms with the ultimate truth. And then we're left with sort of trying to create a reality out of the shadows. And sometimes we can come to grief trying that.
That was wonderful. I completely agree.
That's a poem.
With you.
We could write that.
I'm scribbling that down. Give me three words and I'll be ready to go.
Tell us about that process, the three-word process.
Well, years ago, I was in a writing group with Kurt Courier from Catawba and another person, and we would get together. It was a generative group, and we would each throw out a word, and then we would write for 45 minutes. And you didn't have to use the words. They just hovered, and we'd read what we'd written and go home. And I loved it, and the subconscious started to take over, and I would find I needed to write about things I didn't even know I needed to pursue. After our group fell apart for a while, I was addicted to it. So every time I'm around a group of writers, I'll ask them to give me words with their names on one side and a word on the other. And when I start to write, I pull out three words. They have to be from three different people. I write them at the top, and then off I go.
But see, the idea that the themes in As I Lay Dying kept showing up in the random words you selected, it does suggest, does it not, that maybe those are the words that are, the concepts are so profound that they're rattling to get out, that every word you see is going to be...
Exactly. But I have found Richard Hugo, who wrote a book a long time ago called The Triggering Town, says that if you want to say something in a poem and you have an idea, that's a bad idea. That in some ways, the music of words and the subconscious will take you somewhere. And so I try to surprise myself into not doing the obvious thing, but what I need to write about always pulls me towards it.
But that seems to be a kind of a trick. In other words, if I'm leaning in one direction and I think I'm being straight up, right, then I'm gonna tip. So if I'm pulling out these words and they keep pushing me toward that, how am I sure that I'm going to be surprised and a fresh idea is actually going to come, that the surprising idea emerged from those three words?
Well, the surprise, I think, will be the words and what these words are, and not allowing yourself to think, oh, I'm going to write one more time about burial. But also what Hugo did, and I encourage my students to do this, is to let those words or any words that make music out of them and let music trump the meaning. He would say, I'll write something, and then if there's a word that I think is interesting, within 7 to 11 syllables, I'll try to echo that. Why 7 to 11? He said, poetry doesn't make sense. But it's a way to surprise yourself instead of having a message that you're determined.
This is the stuff of many great spiritual traditions, the I Ching, making sense out of that.
Yes.
A mantra, which is the repetition of words over and over again. Lectio Divina, which is in the Christian, it goes back to the Jewish, which you repeat a word over and over again until it becomes senseless.
Yes.
Because there's a recognition that the word itself is our construction, but it might lead to something ultimate.
And it's very Taoist in a way, in that whatever way the poem is supposed to take, you throw things in its path and it moves on through it no matter what.
Can I get you to read one more?
Yes. I'm going to read a poem called Gravity. The fun encyclopedia has exhausted itself on the floor. All the brain teasers eased apart or lost. My cousin sleeps beside me in bed. Heat melts into the box springs. The keyhole is an eye to the light in the hall. Something's creeping up the stairs. One step, pause, two, each vertebra waits. At last, the breeze from the train track puffs the curtains into a lady's dress, a tent drawing me out and in, spirit slipping through the screen with the window. Angels hover with silver tendrils, so fine, nothing can keep them away. They will shutter their wings, comb my hair, braid themselves into my dreams until everything is ether, ether, counting back, God as weightless as my pillow.
Gravity, a poem by Janice Fuller. The book is called On the Bevel, her latest collection of poetry. You know what I deeply love about that is that while we aspire to this thing that's faster than the speed of light and we can never get to, you know, we are gravity. We actually make shadows. And so we have to kind of get out of our own way.
We do. And yet, you know, there's climbing this, whatever is climbing the stairs is going up. Is it malice? Is it something transcendent? Is it a spirit? And so there's this deep desire to be blown aloft like the curtains, and yet inevitably death, the weight of the body in the mattress that these cousins are lying in, and that tension that's always there.
It's great stuff to have that tension and that aspiration and thoroughly embrace our gravity. Wonderful stuff.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the program today. Janice Moore Fuller she's going to be reading, by the way, at Atherton Mill and Market in Charlotte. That's on Friday. You can find out more information about the book and about Janice's readings at our website, stateofthings.org. The collection is called On the Bevel. And our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.